Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I am a former middle school teacher, I'm a current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this show, I share blueprints and strategies and key ideas. I tell stories and I share some of the big epic mistakes I've made. And lately I've been interviewing certain experts on these big topics like project-based learning and student empowerment and design thinking, because I ultimately believe that teachers are the ones who can help students reach their creative potential. And I'm on this journey as well of trying to make that happen with my own students. Today, I am interviewing someone named Melissa Deutsch. She is a true expert in project-based learning. She is somebody that I interviewed when I wrote the book Vintage Innovation, and just someone that I have talked to for a long term time about her journey with project-based learning. And so I figured she would be a great person to have on this podcast. And I love this because she just has rich experience in terms of classroom experience, leadership experience, curriculum experience, but also academic experience. And she has done some phenomenal research on these topics. So welcome, Melissa Deutsch. All right. We have with us Melissa. I'm suddenly realizing I'm not positive I have your name correctly. So how do you pronounce it?
What do you think?
Is it Deutsch?
Is it? Yeah.
Okay. We have here Melissa Deutsch. And Melissa is somebody who I consider to be a true project-based learning expert. She knows the research. She knows the experience. She has that unique blend of both the teaching experience and the leadership experience. And so it is an honor to have her here on this podcast. I would love for you, Melissa. I would love if you could just share with me kind of from the beginning, how did you get into project-based learning?
Yeah, well, thanks. And John, it's an honor to be here. And same at you as well. Follow your work, have for many years, used your examples. You keep it relevant, which is awesome. Project-based learning is always in style. It's always relevant. It's always applicable. So I appreciate your work too. I use it with my staff and your books and articles, information, your story starters, all of that. You're just such a wealth of resource and really the work that you do to propel project-based learning. We need that. We need things that teachers can use. So thank you for your work as well.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. My experience with project-based learning was really almost an accident when I started teaching. I just didn't have all of the resources I needed with funding and everything cut short. You know, I graduated college and had dreams of these just shelves of supplies and textbooks and all these things. And when I started teaching, our school was very poorly funded. And so coming into the classroom and thinking I'm supposed to teach science and social studies, and if I don't have a textbook, how am I supposed to do this? We just didn't have enough textbooks. So with the five or six that I had, I started from the very beginning. I taught fifth grade and we used it as a resource. So we could use it as a place to go to get information, but we're really going to have to do the learning ourselves. So I knew I had to teach about the universe and galaxies. So instead, we just made them. We made them ourselves. This was back in 2003. So the internet was not something that was widely being used. You know, now for PBL research, your Chromebooks, your devices are amazing. We just didn't have that either. So we used our library, our art supplies, and each other. We would depend on each other. You know, who knows the answer to that question? I became a guide. They would let me know what they needed. And then I would go seek the information and kind of make it available to them to use. So as I was realizing between literacy and not having enough books and social studies, not having enough books and science, not having the kits and materials, we're going to have to make learning happen. So my first 3 years was in that kind of experience. And then I moved to another district where we had all the things. And I was excited to be able to do what I thought, you know, that real teaching was going to be. So I had all my textbooks. I made all the black line masters and packets and, you know, copied the tests and graded all of the multiple choice, and something was missing. I did that for probably a year or two, and then just realized it wasn't filling me and it wasn't filling the students. You know, my students, when I first started teaching, had this kind of joy of learning when they would come in the classroom, because they didn't know, you know, how are we going to do this next? And I found that my students in the next classroom that I had felt the same every day. And it wasn't bringing that joy to me or to them. So I remember I had a social studies textbook, and in fifth grade, typically a fifth grade, you know, timeline would be U.S. history. Mm-hmm. And I got to those chapters that are all about colonial America. Chapter 3 was early America. Mm-hmm. Chapter 4 was the New England colonies. Chapter 5 was the middle colonies. Chapter 6 was the southern colonies. There were 60 or 70 textbook pages. And I just thought, I don't think I can do this again. I don't want to do this again. The vocabulary and the worksheets and coloring maps. And why are we doing this? So instead of 3 months of these four chapters, I said, you know what? I'm going to spin it, and I'm just going to give it back to the kids and say, how would you create a colony? And so we turned it into, you know, King George is going to accept a 14th colony, write a proposal. And so we had to learn how to persuade and write a letter. They got to make a model of their colony. They had to learn about all those aspects of government and resources so your colony can survive. We talked about colonies like Roanoke that didn't survive and why. So we had our main kind of key lessons, mini lessons. And then the kids got in groups and they created, and then they took our school community on tours of their colony. And it changed those chapters into really mundane, kind of boring lessons, into something that kids started to ask questions about and create and work together. And so, you know, knowing what I do now about colonization, I would certainly spin it again and put other people's perspectives and not have it come so much from that, you know, kind of British conquest type of perspective. But that was my first experience with, I guess, doing what I thought might be called project-based learning. And I started to turn many, many, many of my units into that kind of learning. And then I discovered the Buck Institute. And I started to look at their models. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh my gosh, I think I'm doing some of this. And then it was an opportunity to learn and then do more. I didn't know what I was doing. I just knew it felt good and that kids enjoyed it. And they really were learning the things that we set out as our outcomes.
So as we think about this for a moment, one of the thoughts I have is that you had changed this approach. You had essentially used project-based learning with the second group of students that you had. What changes did you see in them in doing the projects versus, I guess, the more traditional scripted curriculum, packets, worksheets, that kind of thing? What did you notice in terms of the changes with the students you were working with?
They were so much more a part of our learning process. You know, they were driving the way and telling me what they needed. And I was planning lessons. It was still work, but it was different. I felt better about where I knew they were taking all of us. They were so much more motivated. They couldn't wait to come into class. You know, the first thing they'd say is, when are we going to get to do our project? They started to see each other differently as well, because that traditional smart kid in class right? Well, now we all see that we have gifts and talents. Mm-hmm. And maybe what child that isn't good at memorizing facts is really good at putting together a story or really good at making models. We all had value. And I think that's really important that everyone sees themselves as part of a learner within the community and sees themselves as important. So that definitely changed how they viewed each other and also how they viewed me. I mean, I think they would come to me with questions. They still knew I had the material, but they didn't expect me to stand there and just kind of disseminate all of my knowledge to them. Or, you know, again, the textbook was a resource, but it wasn't something we had to read page by page. So they became more critical thinkers because what of the material in front of you do you need? What becomes relevant? What do you think when you're looking at this research or the information you're seeing? They would start to question things that they were reading, not only about whether it was relevant, but whether it was biased, whether it had a credible source. So think of all of the inquiry standards that we have that I probably didn't do a great job teaching before, but now the kids are doing a great job learning. So it does. Teaching and learning are both important, but the focus was now on learning instead of teaching. So the whole feel of our classroom changed. Giving kids voice and choice. If you ask anyone that I've worked with or, you know, past or present, that voice and choice to me is always something that I just, even if you don't feel comfortable with a full PBL unit, start giving your kids that voice and choice and they will own it. And you will have so much more buy-in from them. Mm-hmm. So that changed too, I think. They knew they had some flexibility in what they wanted to learn about. And that I would support it, which was
I think there's them. Yeah. I think there's a lot of teachers who feel like PBL sounds great. I would love to do it, but, and then they'll say, I don't have enough materials, or I work in a low SES, you know, low income school. I would love to hear your thoughts on, you know, on one hand, we know, like, let's be real, we need to advocate for funding and equity, and we don't want to be, you know, dismissive of those constraints. But at the same time, you know, when you think about that first school that you were at where you, you know, first piloted PBL, how did you work through some of those constraints, and what was that process like for you?
That's a great question, because if we think of the learning process, and I'm even thinking of some of our science standards for engineering, constraints is a thing to learn. It's a skill. Mm-hmm. How do we work around constraints? And in the real world, constraints are out there. And so if students are always expecting to have all of the things, you know, at their fingertips, they don't learn how to maneuver or pivot or make iterations that aren't going to work. So constraints are important, and sometimes they happen naturally just by the nature of you know, district funding. And sometimes, you know, I would have some materials available and not others and see how they would strategize around that. But I would say some of the best projects that I felt kids really not only enjoyed but learned a lot from didn't require bells and whistles. I didn't have 3D printers or, you know, robotics and, you know, all of those kind of flashy things that have their place too. But I remember a project that we did, you know, PBL has a driving question or task. And for this one, I said, well, Milton Bradley is going to hire you as a game creator. And so you have to pitch a board game that's going to teach about American history. So what do you think is the most important topic in American history? So there's their voice and choice. They started to debate a little bit. And then I had paper. I learned later thicker paper for a board game is good. You know, other paper they could cut. Some kids made little trivia cards. One group wanted to make their pieces that they moved around the board out of origami. So they started to research all these different things they could make with origami. Constraints are great. They kind of push creativity. But between some paper, some coloring supplies, later, you know, we got a little more sophisticated. We had boxes. They had to design a game box. And then the first year we did it, we kind of played each other's games. The next year we did it, I reached out to the community and found some local coffee shops that agreed to take on our games and let people in the, in the real world play them. And we had little feedback cards that the kids created, you know, based on like how easy were the directions to read, how much information did you get from playing the game? There were probably, you know, a handful of questions that we asked. And then strangers were playing our games and giving the kids feedback. And all I had to do was drive them to a coffee shop. You know, it couldn't get more authentic than that. So I also noticed when you make that audience as authentic as you can, the kids have even more buy-in because they know that this means something. It's not just, you know, I'm going to make a game on a piece of paper and my name, you know, my partner next to me is going to play it. So it really does have truth to what they're doing and value again. Some of the projects that we would do, you know, I tried to get creative. I didn't have a ton of money either, but I could purchase some things. So I would make sure that no matter who the child was, they would have what they needed as far as a jumping off point. They could still be successful. And I would always say, if there's something at home you want to bring, I remember one child took apart one of his board games and used some of the pieces because he wanted to bring them in. He got them back when the project was over, but it was important to him. And I would always send a letter home before each project saying, if you have concerns about, you know, materials or your child is asking you for something for this project, please know I do have things in the classroom and just call me. We can talk through that. So I also had a lot of shared materials on hand. I made sure there were just basic supplies, scissors, glue, construction paper. And you'd be shocked at the amazing things that kids can create with just the most basic of things. It does make them kind of think outside that box.
Yeah. As you think about your approach, and we'll get into, you know, I know your PBL journey expands as you get into, you know, your additional education and leadership. But as you think about PBL for a moment, as you first got into project-based learning with your first school context and then later with the second school context, what were some of the fears that you had to face as a teacher?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think some of my fears were about what my peers might perceive as happening in my classroom. PBL classrooms aren't quiet. they're a little chaotic at times. And, you know, my friends and family would laugh because I'm a very organized, I like lists, I like things in place. So to teach that way, at first felt a little uncomfortable for me. But as I realized, it was controlled chaos. The kids were on task. But if someone walked by, it became interesting because they might not see what they thought traditional learning should look like. I did have administration that supported it. So that's good. But you know, between my fellow teachers, because the kids really started to enjoy, I ended up, you know, kind of becoming a specialist, and I taught project-based learning instead of having my own like fifth grade homeroom. So I became in the rotation of scheduling, like art, music, they came to PBL. The kids really liked coming to PBL. And so oftentimes I think the conversations were, you know, they had fun, and not everyone saw that as, you know, as a positive, but I did my best in my school community to say, but it doesn't have to just happen here. Like, this is just what, to me, what learning can look like. It could be a math lesson, a literacy lesson. But that was a fear, was just kind of the perception of others. I think another fear that I had when I started to go in deeply into project-based learning, as we know, if you've been in education for, you know, any length of time, things come and go. You know, that pendulum does, I don't think it goes back and forth. I think it goes all the way around and all the way around. And so there's so many buzzwords. There are so many things that enter into a teacher's profession. It's hard to trust sometimes. What are the things to cling to? What are the things to spend time on? And so PBL became a buzzword. It was something I hadn't heard in my early years of teaching. Mm-hmm. And I felt like if I'm going to invest all this time, is this going to stick? But the more that I did it, I realized the word can come and go. You know, it's the approach to teaching and learning. Mm-hmm. Because in the end, I was doing PBL in my very first classroom and I didn't even know it. So I think as a teacher, there's a fear of taking a risk and kind of doing something different, and families feeling like, you know, is my child still learning? I haven't seen a multiple choice test come home. So there's a little bit of persuasion mm-hmm. and defending that you have to do.
Yeah.
But, you know, I always say I know who I am as an educator. My roots are so deep, you know, they'll go to the center of the earth. And I don't talk mm-hmm. about it. It, you know, I show it in my actions and my beliefs. And as much as I can support others who want to take a risk too, now as a leader, I hope my teachers feel like I support that. And I will be the first to say, let's try it. You can blame me. If something doesn't go right,
yeah,
just say, you know what, Melissa said this was okay. But I encourage that because I would have never figured out mm-hmm. The kind of teacher I wanted to be if those risks that I took hadn't been supported. And everyone mm-hmm. needs to kind of find their truth in what they do. And it makes all that hard work really worth it.
So one of the things that I think of as I hear you describe that is, you know, a concern that teachers will feel sometimes is, I'm worried about my colleagues. I'm worried about my principal. Mm-hmm. I'm worried about parents, guardians, caretakers. How do you, if you are piloting PBL for the first time, or if you were kind of the lone person doing this, how do you communicate that to leadership and to colleagues and to the larger, you know, family, communities, the parents, guardians?
I think knowing that why is really important. And I would often tell people to come in mm-hmm. and see what we're doing. Parents got to be a part of so many of our projects. I think a lot of times it's easy to default to that authentic audience being like, well, I'll invite the parents. It doesn't always have to be that way, but we always kind of had an open invitation. So it wasn't something that I was trying to hide, or something that I was going to close my door and do. Inviting administrators to come in, to come to our events. You know, we had a project we did where we created a museum, and then we had a gallery night, and mm-hmm. I invited the school board. You come see what we're doing. To mm-hmm. don't be afraid to feel strongly about it. And again, the communication with families was so important because I think as an educator, if you're trying something and the families support it and see the importance and they see that joy in their child mm-hmm. and they come home and the parents are saying, my child is learning so much and asking questions, I don't know an administrator who wouldn't support what's happening in that classroom. You know, as I started to do more mm-hmm. and more of it, maybe in a backwards way, because at first it was like, oh, they like this. And then later I was like, I have learning targets, right? Like it has to align to all the same standards and learning targets and have yes. the same outcome. Yes. And so I could draw a line between what we were doing and our state standards and our learning targets. And that line became very thick towards the end of my teaching. And now in my leadership role, our learning targets from standards tie directly to any project, driving question, unit plan, because as long as that is whole, I think the approach to learning mm-hmm. or the method to which kids are learning it becomes more important sometimes than the content, because that content can happen through direct instruction, through, you know, just sitting and getting. The content will be there as long as you can continue to show outcomes and growth and progress in the same kind of way. It was interesting because we would also do engagement surveys, and we know that engagement has a direct connection to achievement. And so all I really was hoping to do was increase engagement, and the rest would take care of itself. So from, you know, a colleague standpoint, a family standpoint, a community standpoint, we all just want the same thing, which is kids to be successful and to have skills. And to me, PBL does both. So it wasn't hard to convince people. I think as soon as I opened my door and could talk about it from the kids' point of view as well. And oftentimes I would bring kids into the conversation. So it wasn't me saying what I think was right, but it was kids talking about the things they were learning. And that's just, you know, I don't know who wouldn't be convinced talking to kids about what they're excited about.
Yeah. One of the things I'm struck by as I hear you describe that is, you know, you mentioned the going back to, you know, getting parents, guardians involved, you know, asking for their participation. One of the mistakes I made was I would often invite parents at the end, right? You know, like, and we would do these family nights. They were really popular. It's where the ultimate launch for the project would go, or they would share their process of how it went. But you know, I would invite parents to be a part of something. And I learned real fast that the way of the ask makes a difference, right? So I did kind of PBL for about 2 years, and then I was partnered with this friend of mine, Javier, and he was starting out his PBL journey. He was a brand new teacher. We both taught social studies. And, you know, he specifically asked for very specific help, knowing where parents had expertise, right? And so, you know, a couple of things that he did immediately, which was smart, was he said, you know, we need help from, you know, helpful adults. And he, and in parentheses, he puts, you know, this could be your dad, this could be your stepdad, your mom's boyfriend, your, you know, like your mom, you're like, and he lists, like, he makes the list massive, uncle, this, that. And so he makes it very clear, we're looking for adults who can be helpful. And then I remember he asked for certain things that I had asked for, but he rephrased it. So, you know, he said, look, John, if you say we're doing STEM projects and any knowledge you have on making and engineering, that's going to, they're going to say, oh, I'm not an engineer. But if you say we're going to be doing these STEM projects, and if you have any experience in construction, help out, you know, and it was amazing because suddenly we got these volunteers. And so I guess looking back on that, I realize I wasn't thinking well about my ask about family involvement. And what I would love to hear from you is you've now have this experience in, you know, in leadership and as a teacher, what advice would you give to teachers in terms of asking for that parental involvement or that family involvement in a way that actually gets people to show up?
Yeah, I think, you know, a couple of things that I started to realize was that, and then again, throughout this, I had my own children, and every family wants to be a part of their child's school. I have not met a family member who, you know, isn't interested or wanting to be a part of it. But I think the more specific you can be, you know, just asking for general help or if anybody wants to come, I think that's hard because they want help, but they're not sure if they're going to be good at it, or are they going to feel awkward? Is what I have to offer good enough? Is that what you're looking for? I think, like you said, being specific with your ask is important. I think throughout you know, I gave a variety of different ways for parents to be involved. So it wasn't always the same kinds of things I was asking for, or even just to come or, you know, to participate in our learning process at some point. You know, by putting those games in the coffee shop, you're on your own time. You can invite grandma. You can come on the weekend.
Yeah.
You know, you can fill out a little slip. You don't even have to come into the building. And we're so appreciative that you participated in our classroom project. So that flexibility, parents' schedules, they're not always available. As a parent, I realized as I got asked a lot to chaperone field trips. And my husband and I would look at each other like, we haven't done one yet this year. Are you taking the day off or am I taking the day off? That was hard, but it's important. And we felt like as parents, we're not showing our children that we care if we don't chaperone a field trip. And I realized as the teacher, I have to be able to offer more than one way for parents to feel important. So it could be something that they provided the class. You know, oh, hey, you know, we just got this whole stack of wallpaper samples from so-and-so's mom who used to be an interior designer. Let's write her a thank you note. Or it could be, you know, we are going to be, you know, doing a project and we need your participation to just come and sit at a table while the kids are in their draft process. And ask a set of questions and give them a little feedback. We're not done. It's not the end of the project, but we need you in the middle because, you know, the feedback from the teacher is different than a feedback from someone who doesn't necessarily have that background knowledge. So, you know, tell me what your project is about while they're building it. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it is inviting parents in. Sometimes it's just asking for what they have to contribute. Again, and flexible hours. Don't always think about that 8 to 4. What about families that might be able to come at, you know, 6 or 7? So our gallery nights, we'd offer a variety of times to come. We would also take advantage of moments that parents were already there. So the board games were also on tables during parent-teacher conferences. Right. So you're sitting and waiting for your child's conference. You can, you know, pick up a game and play it. So it doesn't always have to be an extra thing. It's just a little bit, just one more step in finding all those opportunities to put that project out there. You know, later, and I think now I've been out of the classroom for about 5 years. And I think, man, with Zoom and with recording and how you could share digital recordings and slideshows and really those constraints are lifted in so many ways by how digital we've all become. And I think now after a year of being remote, so many more parents, I think, would be so much more comfortable with some of the technology that we have.
Right. Oh, definitely. So I want to shift gears for a moment and just say, you know, the two different things that I hear often about PBL in terms of resistance to project-based learning is I hear a lot of people say, I teach math, right? That's often, how does this fit into math, right? They can see social studies, science, math is a big one. Or, look, I teach younger students. You know, I'm teaching second graders, first graders. PBL sounds too complex. Mm-hmm. A lot of the stories we hear are, you know, we filmed a documentary and you're like, that's great, but I teach first graders. So what I would love to hear is, you know, what do you say to that teacher who says, I really like PBL. I'm not opposed to it, but I'm teaching. And so I'm going to give you two scenarios here.
Sure.
I'm teaching on one hand, AP calculus, right? Or, you know, I'm teaching that high level math. There's a test involved. I'm really nervous about it. It's math. It's complex math. Or the second side would be, look, I teach first graders. They're not there developmentally. They're just still learning how to read and we're feeling the pressure about their literacy rates, right? what would you say to those two teachers?
Yeah, well, I think I have encountered all of those, you know, but I teach, right? And fill in the blank, kindergarten, students who are nonverbal, you know, mm-hmm. high school. Mm-hmm. And so as a leader, I've been fortunate enough to be able to support K-4 through high school and then did some work actually post-secondary as well. And I have seen success with every single student, no matter the age or, you know, all the talents and gifts that all of our, that our kids bring to the classroom. So mm-hmm. I would say to start with what you're teaching, start with your outcomes. So my guess would be that, you know, first grade teacher, that AP calculus teacher has a set of standards and learning targets that we could look at from a different lens. You know, I like to think about the world around us as a jumping off point. I supported a project in first grade that was a theme of winter. And so the children had voice and choice. They got to choose a part of winter that they wanted to learn more about. Some picked snowflakes, some picked, you know, polar bears. Some picked why trees lose their leaves. But I think if you take the standards and outcomes and come up with one driving question, that's what I tell my teachers all the time, just one driving question. That voice and choice comes through and you can build all of those standards into that. So the AP Calc as well, there is so much mm-hmm. real world application in all of the formulas, in the graphs, in the symbols. You know, I actually took a unit on linear equations. We turned it project-based with a bunch of college kids, and we checked for their efficacy before and after the unit, and it went up. And these were adult mm-hmm. learners. So again, when we talk about engagement will lead to that achievement. And, you know, teachers that are just getting started, it's not about setting down the standards and just doing fun projects. So kids are still learning. And I think convincing teachers of that can sometimes be that first step. And then just looking at it from a different perspective, mm-hmm. instead of thinking about what is it that I have to teach and show, flip that and say, what kind of questions should I be asking? And the kids seeking out the mm-hmm. answers is all part of that process. I think when teachers think of PBL, they think it has to be this big show. It has to be this big, giant, long-term, really complicated thing. And that's not mm-hmm. necessarily true. Sometimes they get that way. You know, but that first grade teacher that teaches a science unit, instead of thinking of the answers, think of the questions you could ask first. That would be my advice.
I love that. That's great. One last question that I have is, so you, a lot of this is focused on your experience as a teacher. Mm-hmm. And then could you describe for a moment, you know, you said that was 5 years ago. What have you transitioned into now?
Yeah. So I now am the director of instruction at a school, which mm-hmm. is just the best experience. I think every experience I've had has been the best experience. Mm-hmm. You know, the thing that I love the most is getting to help teachers get through those struggles and gain confidence in the ideas that they have. You know, a lot of what I hear mm-hmm. is, well, I want to try this, but I'm not sure, or I don't know how. And those are the ones that are taking a risk just to tell me that. You know, I think a lot of times as teachers, mm-hmm. we think maybe our ideas aren't good, or I would never bring this to, you know, my administrator. And I hope my door is always open to say, no, bring all of your ideas and, you know, let me help you turn yeah. that into action. So I think I'm a leader by action. If you need me to be there, you want me to help mm-hmm. lesson plan. If you, you know, let's talk through the questions you have, I'm going to help you find resources. So just like when I was a teacher and I would guide my students through the things they wanted to do and learn, I mean, this is PBL at its best, in my opinion. And my driving question is, how can I help transform teaching and learning to all that I know that it can be? So teachers come in and I definitely, you know, support all their actions. I know everyone's at different comfort levels. Everybody's in different places. Just like we all learn differently. Some like to have it all planned out first. Some just like to kind of wing it and try it and see what happens. And it's all good. There's never wrong. I think, you know, it took me years of PBL, and probably in that last year that I did it, you know, sometimes I'd give a little too much voice and choice. I made mistakes. And I think when teachers come to me now, I'll say, oh gosh, you should hear what I did this one time. And wow, what did I learn from that? That was, you know, that was a great learning experience. And I wish I would have done it differently, because I've been right there, trying all those new things. So, guiding and supporting and what do you need and following through, you know, I think as a leader, if you're not following through, you know, that trust and credibility and relationship is the most important thing. And that's not different than when you're a teacher and with your kids, you need that trust and that credibility and those relationships.
So as you think about this for a moment, you know, one of the questions I hear a lot is, teachers who say, I've been doing PBL. I feel like I'm kind of on my own doing this. And they're saying, I want to get the school on board. And you have the unique perspective of working with leadership, being in a place of leadership, but also in a place of support, right? Mm-hmm. And then also the teaching experience. What advice would you give to a teacher who says, I'd love to make this happen on a larger scale?
I think, you know, it just spreads. You do what you can with what you have, do it well. And, you know, when you walk by a room of smiling, happy, learning children, people are going to say, what's going on in there? What's different in there? Mm-hmm. Have those conversations when they come up. I think if I were just starting, I wouldn't grab my bullhorn and just start, you know, preaching about, oh, everybody should do it. And what I'm doing is better than what you're doing, because that's not at all the case. And you don't want it to come off that way. But yeah, I think if you start with what you have, where you are, and see where it grows, you just keep watering it one little bit at a time. And you know, I think if you feel isolated where you are within your own school community, just crack that door open a little bit, because there are lots of people like us. Sometimes you got to dig a little bit and find them. But, you know, I know some of the opportunities that you've given educators to. There's Facebook groups. There are webinars. And right now, so many things are free, which is great. There's conferences you can go to. And even if it's just you at first, right? I think you would be surprised at how quickly people will be interested, but just like you, maybe fearful to get started too. Once we scratch that surface, I think there are more people that want to try something like that, but don't have the confidence. So come together and do it together and kind of find your village. And whether it's in your building or not in your building, you can, you know, co-plan lessons and whole units about things with someone that doesn't teach at your school, and then talk to each other and see how it went and get feedback from each other. So your circle can be as wide as you allow it to be. And don't let that be the thing that stops you from taking that risk.
All right. Great advice. Thank you so much for this conversation. This is really valuable. And I think a lot of teachers are going to get a lot of value from this.
I really appreciate it. This, you know, I can talk about project-based learning, you know, for hours. Sometimes I do. So I appreciate the conversation with you and the questions. And I hope teachers get value out of the conversation. And, if anything, just take a risk, just try it. It's okay if things work out great, and it's okay if it doesn't, and just keep learning. We ask that of our kids. So it's okay to ask that of yourself too.
Great words. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks, John. I appreciate it so much.
All right. That was Melissa Deutsch, a true expert in project-based learning. I'll tell you what, if you enjoyed this podcast, would you do me a favor and would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts? Again, thanks for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.